Fawa's University Times. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A 24-story London apartment building is still smoldering hours after going up in flames early Wednesday, killing at least 12 and sending dozens to hospitals. The inferno swept rapidly through the Grenfell Tower in one of the British capital's deadliest fires in a generation. Amina Sharif was a witness to the tragedy.
It went literally up. It started firing from the outside all the way to the roof and then all the way down. And then by then we can see a lot of children and a lot of mothers and fathers screaming for help, 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 and putting their hands on the window and asking us to help them. And we couldn't do nothing. And we can see like the stuff on the side was falling off, collapsing. And we were just standing there hopeless, screaming, and they were screaming.
It took more than 200 firefighters hours to gain control of the blaze. They rescued dozens of people. London Fire Brigade official Steve Apter said crews are still trying to douse the flames.
There are still pockets of fire yet to be extinguished in particularly difficult places to reach. And hence I've said we will be on scene for a long time.
The cause of the blaze still not known. Prime Minister Theresa May said an investigation will be undertaken.
Of course, once the scene is secure, once the recovery is complete, then an investigation will take place into the cause of the fire.
The incident could delay her announcement on forming a new government following last week's election. In the Somali capital Mogadishu, gunmen reportedly hold several hostages in a restaurant following a suicide bombing late Wednesday that killed at least 9 people. The attack claimed by the Islamist group Al-Shabaab. Security officials said the suicide attacker rammed an explosives-laden car into the entrance of the Posh Hotel before gunmen stormed the restaurant. This is VOA News. Republican Congressman Steve Scalise is reported in critical condition following surgery for wounds sustained in a shooting in suburban Washington Wednesday. Scalise practicing for a charity baseball game when a lone gunman identified as 66-year-old James Hodgkinson of Belleville, Illinois, opened fire before being killed by security officers. 3 others were wounded. Timothy Slater is an agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Obviously, we are looking to glean what we can from the contents regarding his electrical devices that he owned. Law enforcement has reason to believe that the shooter has been in Alexandria, Virginia area since March of this year. The FBI has issued again seeking information poster that is located on our website asking the public to come forward with information on the shooter.
While no motive has been firmly established, Hodgkinson had posted material critical of President Donald Trump on social media and was a member of anti-Republican groups on Facebook. After the shooting, Speaker Paul Ryan took to the House floor and appealed for unity.
We are united. We are united in our shock. We are united in our anguish. An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us.
President Trump, who visited the wounded congressman late Wednesday, denounced the shooting as a very brutal assault. The bipartisan charity ball game will go on as scheduled Thursday. In San Francisco, United Parcel Service employee opened fire at one of the company's package delivery facilities Wednesday, killing 3 co-workers before taking his own life. 2 other UPS employees were wounded. An Iraqi police commander said Iraqi forces repelled a major counterattack by Islamic State early Wednesday south of the old city of Mosul. He said dozens of IS fighters were killed. Iraq also claimed to have captured the Zanjili district north of the city's historic center. U.S. Major General Joseph Martin, commander of the Combined Joint Forces land component, said the military defeat of Islamic State in Iraq is inevitable and pointed to Mosul as an example.
Since last October, the ISF have liberated hundreds of thousands of civilians in Mosul, and life is returning to normal in portions of the city. I recently walked the streets of East and West Mosul, and I saw for myself that markets and their businesses are reopening. Civilians are moving around the city and living their lives.
Meanwhile, in Syria, witnesses said IS militants in the embattled city of Raqqa are disguising themselves as civilians to avoid intensifying U.S.-led airstrikes and shooting anyone caught trying to escape. U.S. Defense Department said an Iranian military vessel trained a laser on an American helicopter accompanying 3 warships in the Strait of Hormuz Tuesday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf declares her assets and urges others to do the same.
The reason is that all of this is in continuation of our desire to show the right example for all our officials so that we can ensure transparency, particularly at a time when the citizen of corruption has become a topical issue in Liberia and abroad.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. Burundi rejects a UN Human Rights Commission of Inquiry report prior to its release. A new report says Kenya's mobile internet speeds have surpassed the United States, and the International Criminal Court calls on Libya to arrest and surrender Saif al-Islam Gaddafi.
Whether Mr. Gaddafi has been released, whether he has not been released, what is required under the ICC jurisprudence, the decision of the appeals chamber, is that he be turned over to the court in The Hague for trial.
Julian Nichols is the senior trial lawyer in the ICC's case against Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. Scientists find a way to prevent critical stage in malaria infection, and a new report says more women in the workplace could add trillions of dollars to the world economy. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has declared her assets the second time since she was sworn in as Africa's first elected female president in 2006. According to the latest declaration, the president earned an annual salary of nearly $18,000 plus $72,000 in allowances. She has nearly 70,000 deposited in Liberian banks and nearly $1 million in foreign banks. Liberia's Information Minister Eugene Nabwe says the president wants to continue to set an example for all officials of government and presidential candidates in this year's election to follow, particularly at a time when corruption has become a topical issue in Liberia and abroad. Nabwe defends why the president has more money deposited in foreign banks than in Liberian banks.
The reason is that all of this is in continuation of our desire to show the right example for all our officials so that we can ensure transparency, particularly at a time when the citizen of corruption has become a topical issue in Liberia and abroad. Especially wants to take the lead in being very transparent with our finances, and by so doing, encourage other officials of government to do the same.
So are you saying that the president is calling on not just her cabinet, but also people who are running for office to do the same?
Definitely, and also other members of the other branches of government, so that we as a government, as a people, can enhance our fight against corruption and show how transparent we are.
Mr. Minister, the president's annual salary is put at $1,645,500 Liberian dollars. If I can convert this to U.S. dollars, would that be $17,505? Is that realistic?
That is what our constitution has prescribed, and the president is following the constitutional requirements. In addition to that, there are other immunities and benefits that she accrues as the president of the republic, including travel allowances when she travels, including the fact that her security is paid for, and all of that. But the president is a very frugal person. She continues to live within her means. She maintains a very tight hand on what she has to spend.
I spoke to one presidential candidate in this year's election, and one of the promises that he has made is that if he's elected president, he will make sure his salary and that of his vice president will have to be reduced.
Perhaps he's not reading the constitutional provisions properly, because under our constitution, a sitting president cannot change the salary structure. But that aside, the salary of the president of the republic is not as huge as people would think, and as you have seen with the declaration of President Sirleaf's income tax returns and also her declaration of her assets, it shows that some of the politicians are making commitments and promises without even assessing the current situation.
When the president first released her assets, I think one of the reasons she did it was to make sure that the fight against corruption was going to be prominent. Now, it seems to me as she's about to leave office, people keep saying there's more corruption now in Liberia than when she took over.
That is not true. If you look at all of the index that have been published, you realize that a whole lot has been done regarding how Liberia has progressed since President Sirleaf took over as President of the Republic. Since 2006, she established several transparency institutions that are working. So yes, a lot of progress has been made regarding our fight against corruption. Yes, we have more to do, but to say that the corruption is more prevalent now than before is a misstatement.
I noticed that the president seems to have less money deposited in Liberian banks and more money deposited in foreign banks. Why not more in Liberia and less in foreign banks?
This is a simple matter because, as you well know, President Sirleaf worked as an international civil servant for several years, and all her benefits and whatever she accrued were deposited in foreign banks. Also, she won the Nobel Peace Prize. That prize was deposited in a bank in the United States. In addition to that, she invested her savings, her pension, in mutual funds. In Liberia, where she is the president, she has domesticated her savings from Liberia. Her salary is domesticated here at local banks. Her farm, her properties that she owns, all are here. The key thing is that all of her financials have been left there for the public to see. She has been very transparent to release her income tax returns and also to release her statement of assets. And this is what's more important. She has no hidden wealth. All that she has is what has been presented to the public.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has called on Libya to arrest and surrender Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. This after Islam Gaddafi was reportedly released by an armed group that has held him since 2011. The ICC had charged Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of Libya's former longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi, with crimes against humanity for murder and persecution of opponents during his father's rule. But critics say Bensouda's demand for Saif al-Islam Gaddafi's arrest is misplaced because they say he could play a key role in reconciliation process to stabilize Libya. Julian Nichols, senior trial lawyer at the ICC in the case, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that victims of the crimes against humanity allegedly committed by Saif al-Islam need justice.
What I can say is this, that we have been following the open source reports as well as our own investigative techniques and sources about the report that he has been released from the battalion holding him. There were reports about a year ago which proved not to be correct, so we are monitoring these reports. But whatever the case, in the sense of whether Mr. Gaddafi has been released, whether he has not been released, what is required under the law, under the ICC jurisprudence, the decision of the appeals chamber, is that he be turned over to the court in The Hague for trial. And the statement reaffirms that position of the Office of the Prosecutor.
Will the ICC issue an official arrest warrant for Saif Islam Gaddafi?
There's an arrest warrant in effect, which has been in effect since June 2011. That warrant has never gone away. It has never stopped being valid. So the warrant is there, and Mr. Gaddafi should be surrendered on the basis of that warrant.
Has the ICC called on the Libyan government to do so per the call for his arrest and surrender to the ICC?
Yes, the prosecutor has done that multiple times in her statements to the Security Council, which she briefs twice a year in New York on the Libya situation. The prosecution has done that in filings as well. And in fact, Libya has been found to be in non-compliance by the court for its failure to surrender Saif Islam al-Gaddafi to the court.
Julian, some people are saying that calling for his arrest right now is not looking at how stable the country is, because the country is grappling with political and security instability, and that calling for Islam's arrest is pretty much a non-starter looking at the political and security climate in Libya at the moment. What do you say to that?
I would not say that it is a non-starter. It is a difficult situation. Previously, the legitimate authorities in Libya have stated in a filing to the court that they did not have custody of Mr. Gaddafi, that he was being held by this unit in Zintan that was not under their control. And the warrant is like any other warrant. It's a warrant for his arrest. It's been issued by the court. And even if the situation in Libya remains difficult, he needs to be surrendered under that warrant.
What do you say to people who in support of the government are saying that the government doesn't have the capacity to be able to carry out the arrest warrant issued by the ICC, and that possibly when the government has control over the entire country, they'll be able to meet that challenge? What do you say to that?
That very well may be. And what the prosecutor calls on is that once the authorities in Libya are in a position to surrender Mr. Gaddafi, they must do so. But there has been a recognition in the prosecutor's statements and in our filings that the government may have difficulty doing so at the moment.
Julian Nichols is the senior trial lawyer in the ICC's case against Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from The Hague. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 15th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. The Burundian government has rejected a UN Commission of Inquiry report prior to its release in Geneva. The commission was established in 2016 through Resolution 3324 to investigate human rights violations and abuses in Burundi since April 2015 and to determine whether such violations may constitute international crimes. As Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, the Burundian government took a preemptive strike on Wednesday by calling the report politically motivated.
This is not the first time the Burundi government rejects the United Nations Human Rights Report on the country. In March 2017, the Human Rights Commission released a report indicating violations of the human rights committed by the Burundi ruling party youth wing Imbonerakure and the police. The Human Rights Commission accused the Burundi police of arbitrarily arresting the opposition members and also torturing them. Martin Nivyabandi is the Burundi Minister of Human Rights.
The government gave an opportunity to dispute the content of the report. And unfortunately, when the commission of inquiry was set up, it was not by consensus. It was forced by the European Union to condemn some high authorities, the military one, civil one, as well as in police, ranked official.
The European Union and the Burundi relation continued to deteriorate since 2015, when human rights violations were reported in the country. After violent protests that led to the European Union suspending direct aid to the Burundi government. Early this month, the Burundi government accused the European Union of trying to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza's government. During the 35th Human Rights Council session last week, the United Nations Human Rights High Commissioner Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein accused Burundi of continued commitment of human rights violations. Burundi Human Rights Minister says that the report had its own agenda.
But unfortunately, we realize that this report doesn't clarify the situation for human rights in our country. Rather, it was presented with the goal of showing that the perpetrators of violation of human rights are high officials of this country and take them to the national court. Obviously, it is evident that the goal was that, and the conclusion of the report, of the former report of UNIB, is that. That's why we say if the report is politically oriented, you cannot accept.
Burundi government had last year suspended all forms of cooperation with the United Nations Human Rights Office. The Council's independent commission was declared persona non grata, with the current commission of inquiry not been able to enter the country to investigate human rights violations that took place since 2015. According to the Burundian government, more than 500 people were killed since 2015 and hundreds of thousands have fled to the neighboring countries. The country now is steadily gaining stability, but the National Human Rights Commission says forced disappearances are still reported in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The first quarter state of the internet report from Akamai Technologies has been released, and one surprising find is that Kenya's mobile internet speeds have surpassed the United States. David Belson, editor-in-chief of Akamai Technologies, talked to Ricky Shryak about other findings in the report on Africa's connectivity.
So I think in many cases, you were seeing some of the African countries going to more of a mobile-first model now. So instead of investing in trying to, you know, pull fiber across, in many cases, you know, unfriendly terrain, they're moving more to a mobile-first model. And then, you know, I think also based on the fact that so many people, you know, across the African countries have mobile phones, what we're likely seeing is greater deployment of mobile infrastructure than wired infrastructure. For Kenya, at least in the first quarter of 2017, is that the speeds, when I looked at the networks that make up the average, it is overwhelmingly comprised of a single network provider. The speeds seen at that network provider are largely carrying the average. Whereas in the U.S., you wind up having a mix of, you know, a number of AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and others.
When we talk about speed, do we also talk ever about geographical coverage?
That's certainly an influence. So, yeah, and then you start talking about things like capitalism ultimately comes into it and government support and things like that, where, you know, in Senegal, you may have better coverage because it's a, you know, part of it is, you know, maybe it's a much smaller geography. So there's more people clustered in your particular rural area. It may be easier to reach subscribers, users in those in that kind of area with a mobile signal, whereas in rural Illinois, you know, the incumbent providers may look at that and say, well, we're going to invest in infrastructure in Chicago, but because this particular town is X miles outside, and you know, we've got something there, you know, there's not necessarily enough subscribers or users there to make it worth a significant investment.
One of the findings you had in your report also was that the internet in Gabon was down for unknown reasons at one point. How often do these kind of unknown outages just happen in places throughout Africa? Are they more common in, on the African continent than other places, or are they just as common everywhere else?
With Gabon, you know, this was a multi-hour outage, so it was a little more significant. It was like 12, it's like about 14 hours. In many cases, these types of outages generally have a reason. Part of the challenge is that they're not always publicized. So, you know, as an example, the ongoing outages in Syria, and then they've done that before. The similar outages in Iraq, where the government has said, hey, we're going to try to prevent cheating on nationwide exams, so we're going to shut down the internet for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is. So they take down the internet in the entire country to prevent some set of students from cheating on an exam. So that, you know, I have colleagues with contacts over there, so they find out about it, and they, you know, they'll write it up. A lot of times that kind of thing gets this more media coverage, but, you know, in some cases these types of outages may not get much media coverage, which means that I wind up writing in the report that the cause was unknown.
David Belson is editor-in-chief of Akamai Technologies. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Massachusetts, the United States. Researchers have identified a weakness in the malaria parasite that could halt mosquito-borne infection in its tracks, not only offering the possibility of a cure, but a way to interrupt transmission. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
It's being called the malaria parasite's Achilles heel, a protein that the parasite, Plasmodium falciparum, uses to infect red blood cells. By blocking the protein called PFAP2I, the malaria parasite cannot enter the cells, where it replicates billions of times before bursting forth into the bloodstream. The hallmark symptoms of malaria, including high fever and chills, come in waves every 48 hours, each time the parasite reproduces, halting the so-called invasion phase. According to lead researcher Manuel Yinas, could potentially stop the infection, offering a cure.
Invasion has been, for a long time, considered, you know, one of the key parasite-specific processes that, if inhibited, would then prevent the full-blown massive infections that one normally gets.
Yunus and colleagues at Pennsylvania State University have identified and characterized PFAP2I, finding that it regulates more than 150 parasitic genes, nearly 20% of which are known to be involved in red cell invasion. The findings are reported in the journal Cell Host and Microbe. For the past 50 years, Yunus says researchers have been trying to find a way to attack the invasion phase, typically with vaccines that harness the immune system. Because the parasite has dozens of mechanisms that pull it into red blood cells after attaching to their surface, Yunus says it's hard to raise an immune response to block them all. Yunus says a compound that interferes with the parasite's PFAP2I protein has the potential to stop invasion in a single action.
You will ultimately impact a very large number of genes that are involved in invasion, but you only need to target one protein specifically, and that's the AP2I protein, because if it doesn't function properly, it's never turning on this large set of invasion genes that are required for that process to actually ever occur.
Yunus says the next step is to actually develop a drug that targets the parasitic protein. In addition to a possible cure, an agent that blocks PFAP2I has the potential to break the transmission cycle, since there would be few, if any, daughter parasites in the bloodstream to infect biting mosquitoes. There are an estimated 212 million cases of malaria each year, and the disease kills 429,000 people, most of them young children, in sub-Saharan Africa. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A new report by the International Labour Organization, the ILO, says getting more women into the world labour market would add trillions of dollars to the global economy and boost tax revenues. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the World Employment and Social Outlook Trends for Women 2017 report in Geneva.
The International Labour Organization is calling for a narrowing of the gender gap, which it says is widespread, persistent, and substantial in the world of work. Data show that just over 49% of women globally are in the labor force, a rate nearly 27% lower than that for men. The ILO says this situation is expected to remain unchanged in 2018. Deborah Greenfield, ILO Deputy Director for Policy, says the group of 20 leaders have committed themselves to reducing the gender gap in work participation rates between men and women by 25% by the year 2025. Greenfield says huge benefits would accrue to women, society, and the economy if this goal is met.
This would have the potential to add $5.8 trillion, measured in U.S. dollars, to the global economy. This could also unlock large potential tax revenues. We estimate roughly $1.5 trillion globally, most of it in emerging and developed countries.
The report says North Africa, the Arab states, and Southern Asia have the lowest number of women in paid labor. It says these regions would benefit most from narrowing the gaps, which exceed 50 percentage points in participation rates between men and women. The ILO says society must change its attitudes toward the role of women in the world of work and not fall back on the outdated excuse that it is unacceptable for a woman to have a paid job. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Gunmen were holding an unknown number of people hostage inside a popular restaurant in Somalia's capital on Wednesday. And that's it for this Thursday, June 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Music time in Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.